From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Last month, a man out hunting for coyote in the southwestern part of the state accidentally shot a northern gray wolf instead. The wolf was a 70-pound, 3-year-old female named Echo.
Echo received her name and a radio collar in Cody, Wyoming back in January of 2014. She then traveled 450 miles through Wyoming and Utah until she was shot on December 28th in the Tusher Mountains outside of Beaver.
Michael Robinson studies wolves and wolf policy as a member of the Arizona-based Center for Biological Diversity. He joins us in the first part of the show to talk about this killing, the state of Utah's policy on wolves, and why an open season on coyotes is basically an open season on wolves.
Then in the second half of the show, we'll talk about this year's Audubon Christmas Bird Count held up here in Park City on December 14th. Janice Garner is a wildlife biologist who participated in the count.
She joins us to talk about what birds were and were not identified and what trend birders are witnessing in sightings, populations, and migrations.
All that and a review of the past year with respect to environmental stories, issues, and topics.
You can join in on the conversation with both our guests today by posting to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay tuned.
KPCW presents on the Egyptian stage the Subdudes, reunited for their first tour in 17 years. This is a New Orleans-grown gumbo of roots music playing three nights at the Egyptian, January 9th, 10th, and 11th. The Subdudes, sponsored by KPCW. Tickets at parkcityshows.com. The Egyptian is a nonprofit organization and proud supporter of KPCW.
Hi, I'm Mitch Martino.
And I'm Marta Mishral. We're from Park City High School.
Stay in touch with all things miners with our weekly Miner Nation report.
We'll bring it to you every Monday morning during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher.
And in the afternoon with The Local View with Randy Barton.
Highlights, scores, schedules.
All things Park City Miners athletics.
The Miner Nation report is brought to you by
UPS Stores,
Rich Fine, Realtor,
and Elliott Work Group.
Go Miners! Miners.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson across the board. On the phone with us is Michael Robinson. He is with the Center for Biological Diversity. He's an expert on wolves and wolf habitat and wolf policy here out west. And many states have established policies out west, and some of them are quite different than others and quite different from those policies back east. And I guess hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about how they all vary and differ. Michael, thanks for joining us on This Green Earth this morning.
Good morning, Chris and Nell. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, because we want to learn more about what happened with Echo and also what is going on a larger sense with wolf policies out west. So let's start with this incident. We kind of touched on it in the intro. This wolf was shot down in the southwestern part of Utah. Kind of unusual, I thought, to begin with, isn't that?
Yes, it's hundreds of miles from where wolves are reproducing, where a breeding population exists in the northern Rocky Mountains of Wyoming, Idaho, Montana, and adjoining areas of Oregon and Washington. So this wolf traveled a long ways, and we don't know 100% that she is indeed the same wolf who was named as part of a children's contest once she became a bit of a minor celebrity after being repeatedly observed and photographed on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. But it does seem likely she is the same wolf who was named Echo. We will find out when DNA tests come in. This wolf was a radio-collared female, 3 years old. She had been captured just about a year ago in Wyoming, east of Yellowstone National Park, and outfitted with a radio collar, which for some reason was no longer functioning. Mm. And she had been seen in October and photographed and marveled at by visitors at Grand Canyon National Park, and also welcomed by local businesses and residents in the region. And then she wasn't seen for a while. Then a wolf was photographed and reported on near Cedar City, again a radio-collared wolf. And then this wolf died near Beaver, which is north of Cedar City. So it appears likely she is the same animal, but we don't know that for sure. And the significance is that it's been at least 70 years since a wolf had been in that part of of Arizona and Utah. And they had originally been exterminated, and they're starting to make a comeback. But they face, obviously, a lot of obstacles, a lot of perils.
So given the unusuality of this sighting, what was this wolf, you know, doing in this area? Is it high-quality habitat? Is this wolf, you know, breaking away from the pack and looking for a new territory? Mm-hmm. What's the probable reasoning for this?
Well, indeed, wolves do take their own journeys away from their natal pack, seek out potential mates, seek out a home where they can find enough to eat and to feed a family eventually. That's part of natural wolf behavior. And because wolves have been wiped out from vast areas of the United States, from the vast majority of our country, sometimes they go on epic migrations. And scientists have indeed identified the north rim of the Grand Canyon and adjoining areas in southern Utah as ideal wolf habitat through models that take into account road density, take into account the density of potential prey animals, such as deer, and that look at other factors that have shown to be associated with wolves' success in other areas. So based on those models, scientists have said the North Rim and adjoining areas in southern Utah are very important for long-term sustainability of wolf populations to ensure that there's enough wolves widely enough distributed across a broad enough landscape that they can be resilient if one population is, you know, faces, you know, for example, a disease or anything else that may be a threat, that there's long-term persistence. The Grand Canyon is key to what scientists have identified as necessary for true recovery of wolves.
Right. Well, wolves may want to repopulate the North Rim and the southwestern part of the state, but whether the state is interested in having them there is another thing entirely, you know, ranchers and landowners alike. And we'll get to that in a minute. But this wolf was shot outside of Beaver on December 28th, I believe, by a hunter who was out hunting coyote. So he accidentally shot this wolf. It's interesting, and I said in the intro that this state has a policy, has a program that allows coyote hunting every day. It's an open season on coyote. And what are your thoughts about that with respect to how that can threaten wolves, populations, and migration?
Yeah, Chris, well, not only a open season on coyotes, but also a bounty on coyotes, right, encouraging people to kill them, and the taxpayers pay for it. And you know what seems to be one of the less wise investments of public resources, but certainly it encourages a mentality of seeing coyotes as an enemy, as something to be vanquished. And that's long been the attitude of the livestock industry towards wolves. And they have managed to get a small but fervid group of people to share their hatred of natural carnivores and share their enthusiasm for eradicating natural carnivores or suppressing the populations. Mm-hmm. And that appears to be enshrined in part, at least, in state policy. So it is a danger to wolves. It's also interesting that And we have yet to see what an investigation will report. But this was, was the first reports that came out were mistaken for a coyote. And typically, the Justice Department does not pursue cases in which someone makes such a claim, even though the Endangered Species Act supports the notion that one has to know what one is shooting before one pulls the trigger. And that's also a part of every other law. You can't make that excuse if you're, if you accidentally kill a game species. For example, if the same hunter had shot a deer and said, "Oh, I thought it was a coyote." I mean, they're roughly the same color, and at a distance one can mistake a shape in brush. They right. probably would be charged with a game violation and pay a penalty. And yet, for a very rare endangered wolf, perhaps the only wolf in the state of Utah at present, we'll see, but oftentimes these crimes are treated very lightly, and the people who commit them are allowed to to escape prosecution.
The
point about knowing what you're shooting before you pull that trigger is an important one, I think. But before we go too much further, how easy or difficult is it to mistake or confuse wolves and coyotes? What are the differences that people can expect to see?
Wolves are bigger animals. They appear bulkier. They have longer legs than coyotes.
How much bigger?
They can be, depending on the individual animal, a wolf can easily be 70 or 70 pounds or larger. A coyote is likely to be half that size. Though that's not a precise or average weight that's off the top of my head. Wolves have sort of a blunter snout. If you look at the profile of a coyote, you see more of a pointed snout, and the same with its ears are a little bit more pointed as well. So admittedly, if you're under field conditions at a distance, it may be hard to tell size of an animal. It can be challenging under some conditions, again, with vegetation that may intervene, to figure out what the animal is. But this is a basic of firearm safety and of hunting safety, is to know your target and to be 100% sure before you pull the trigger. That kind of responsibility should be enforced, in our view.
Well, that's interesting you mention that, because here in the state, not only, like you mentioned, there's a bounty on coyotes. You can hunt in this state coyotes, no license, no permit required, just online registration. There is no limits on the type of firearm that can be used. Whatever you got, it's good. And there's no limit on the number you can bag. Kill as many as you want. And like we said, if you bring them in, show proof of kill, either hide or scalp or so, that's $50 per coyote. So you can imagine the enthusiasm people may have to want to go out and shoot what is basically considered by many people varmints, no different than, a pest. And so wolves are going to be, I'm suggesting that wolves are going to be mistaken. And it's amazing that you're saying, Michael, that this guy may not face any type of penalty from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Well, we have yet to see what decision the Justice Department will make.
Right.
And we have yet to see what investigation comes up with. But that's based on a previous pattern of non-enforcement from the Justice Department that is very disturbing. And one of the lessons that comes out of this, I believe, is that it's vitally important to keep endangered wolves on the endangered species list, because the few protections they have, which obviously were not enough in the case of Echo, or whichever wolf this turns out to have been who was shot on December 28th, despite that, we need at least the possibility of a robust public education program so that people know what the difference is and know that wolves are endangered and should not be shot. And that will save lives, because most people don't want to violate the law. And we need real enforcement. We need a recovery plan that ensures that more than just a handful of wolves, or one wolf whose death is a huge setback to the species, that instead we have hundreds of wolves in Utah and throughout the West in areas that don't now support them, including states like Colorado. And that will ensure, again, the resilience of the species so that one wolf's death is not such a setback. And that all of these measures can only come about if the wolf stays on the endangered species list.
Right.
So if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Michael Robinson from the Center for Biological Diversity about coyotes and wolves and the policy surrounding them. Michael, would you talk a little bit about, you know, state and federal policies for wolves in this western and southwestern area where we're located?
Sure, Nell. In the northern Rocky Mountains, so certainly north of Park City, but including a small sliver of northeastern Utah, wolves are off the endangered species list, and that's by congressional fiat, not through the science-based criteria of the endangered species list, but through a rider that passed Congress in one of the budget impasses and the fiscal cliffs back in 2011.
Why am I
not surprised?
The area
where wolves are off the endangered species list and don't receive federal protection is that small sliver of Utah, Idaho, Montana, and the eastern portions of Oregon and Washington. And so those areas, there's a lot of pressure on wolves, a lot of wolves being shot as part of hunting seasons and by federal agriculture department agents, predator killing agents. A lot of wolves being trapped and strangled in wire snares, again, by individuals and by the federal government. And so wolf populations have been declining from a high near 2,000 right before they were taken off the endangered species list to a number that's hard to estimate at present, but maybe several hundred below that high and continuing to decline most likely in the future. And then the Mexican gray wolf in Arizona and New Mexico, a small portion of southeastern Arizona and southwestern New Mexico, is also on the endangered species list, as is the, and there's only about 100 animals in the wild. And then there are gray wolves in the upper Midwest that were recently returned to the endangered species list in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin primarily. Returned there by a court order, and wolves in Wyoming were recently returned to the endangered species list thanks to litigation that several conservation groups, including the Center for Biological Diversity, were a part of. So they're now protected as well. So the only places they're not protected by federal law is, as I said, in that area in the northern Rocky Mountains. And state policy really has to follow federal policy. Although the federal government has been very lax and has given the states a lot of responsibilities and states have used those responsibilities in some cases unwisely, particularly in the case of the Mexican wolf.
Wolves are all around the country. What state do you think does a good job with managing populations?
Well, as I said, at the moment, It is federal policy that is managing wolves, and wolves really occupy a very small proportion, just about 5% of their original range in the lower 48 states. Hmm.
That's incredible.
We really think that, So they're an endangered species. There are various loopholes that allow people and agencies to kill wolves under some circumstances, but the fact that they're an endangered species really limits that, and has given wolves the opportunity to come back in significant numbers in the northern Rocky Mountains and the upper Midwest. So states are under so much pressure from special interests, particularly the livestock industry in the West, to reduce predator numbers, to persecute wolves. And even though the populace at large in Utah and other states really feels, you know, a lot of people know that wolves are good for the environment, help keep the balance of the ecosystems and support wolves, nonetheless, state policy doesn't follow that. So federal protection is really what wolves need now, rather than looking at what states might be less bad than other states if they were, you know, taken off the endangered species list, which there really is a threat that they will be taken off the list.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned, too, the benefit of wolves to the food chain or biosystems as a whole. There have been studies done in Yellowstone that show that increased wolf populations result in better control of elk populations, which results in lower damage to vegetation, particularly along riparian areas and stream areas, which then improves the vegetation and the food source for grizzly bears, of all things. So because they're feeding on the berries, which the elk would otherwise be trampling on. But now that the wolves are around, the elks are on the move, and they're more wary, and they're not spending as much. They're not damaging the stream, the sides of streams, which creates sediment runoff in the stream. There's so many linkages and values associated with having wolves in biosystems, from apex predator to apex predator. It's amazing, but, you know, here it's what the ranchers and the livestock industry want. They want fewer wolves to protect their sheep and their cattle.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there's an emerging and growing body of scientific literature that obviously you've read at least some of it, Chris, that
thank you.
Show the benefits of wolves, as you note, to grizzly bears, to vegetation, for example, cottonwood saplings along streams and low-visibility valleys in Yellowstone National Park. Those saplings matured into full trees with all the benefits that those trees provide the ecosystem.
Right.
Because the elk were avoiding those low visibility areas after wolves were reintroduced. And pronghorn antelope reviving in Grand Teton National Park, south of Yellowstone, it sounds counterintuitive, but what was happening is the pronghorn fawns were being eaten by coyotes, which selectively hunted them down, a substantial meal for a family of coyotes, but not so substantial for a family of wolves. They wouldn't selectively hunt down coyote fawns, but they were killing coyotes, which they saw as competitors, and that allowed the pronghorn population to stop going down and start going up again. And there's so many other examples that's now being documented in the scientific literature.
That particular example of, you know, an increase in the number of wolves leading to a decrease in the number of coyotes, I think is especially interesting here for Utah, where the state has, you know, in the majority of the state, it's managed by the federal government. But in the area that it's not, you know, Utah's basically saying we don't want anything to establish, no wolves.
Right.
But we also don't want coyotes.
It's right in their management plan, Michael. This is right out of the state's wolf management plan. The presence of wolves in Yellowstone has had profound impacts on coyote populations, including reducing the density by 50% and reducing pack sizes. Right out of the state's wolf management plan.
Yeah, and that management plan was written by people from different viewpoints under supervision of the State Wildlife Agency. And I know, for example, the Western Wildlife Conservancy with Kirk Robinson, no relation to me, was probably, you know, I was just taking a guess, they were probably responsible for ensuring that some of the science got into the plan. But one has to look at closely is the provisions for allowing wolves to live or, to the contrary, ensuring in some cases that they don't live. And I have not studied the Utah State Management Plan, but I don't believe that it's a true welcome mat for wolves to return to their ancient
to say the least.
That's a nice way of putting it. We're going to have to wrap up, but we want to take a couple minutes. Michael, just tell us a little bit about the Center for Biological Diversity. What do you guys do?
The Center for Biological Diversity fights for endangered species and for the places that these imperiled wildlife and native plants as well, the places where they live, the whole ecosystems. And we work through public education, through a law and administrative appeals, for example, to the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, Fish and Wildlife Service, and we work through public organizing as well. And we have a great track record of saving endangered species, including saving wolves. So check us out at www.biologicaldiversity.org.
Perfect.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to chat about this really interesting subject. And like I say, going forward, it's going to be really interesting to see what penalties are imposed on this hunter who says he accidentally killed a wolf.
It will be interesting to see. And the larger picture of whether wolves will stay protected under the Endangered Species Act. Thank you very much, Neil and Chris.
Thanks, Mike. We'll be in touch. Hey,
okay.
Let's take a break for some sponsors and underwriters. And when we come back, we We're going to turn the subject towards birds and the Christmas bird count that was recently held here in Park City.
And across the country.
And across the country. Very good. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
The 2015 FIS Freestyle Ski World Cup is coming to Deer Valley Resort, January 7th through the 10th. The event kicks off with a live performance Wednesday evening by the Chris Robinson Brotherhood on Lower Main Street. All events are free to the public and each night with fireworks. Brought to you by the United States Ski and Snowboard Association, a not-for-profit organization and proud supporter of KPCW.
This is Alyssa Daly with Republic Services, sponsor of This Green Earth on KPCW. During the holiday season, Americans discard 25% more trash than normal. 80% of what is discarded during the holidays could be recycled, from gift boxes to wrapping paper and holiday cards. Recycling during the holiday season helps keep Summit County clean.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, topics, news items, concepts of sustainability, etc.
Really, just anything we want to talk about.
Wolf policy management. We're going to talk about birds in a little bit with Janice Garner. She is a wildlife biologist and participated in this year's Christmas bird count. Have you ever done that, Nell?
No, I haven't. I don't think I'm a skilled enough birder to be a valuable
really?
Member of that team. I should be.
You went to Yale.
But but I'm not. I know.
What?
I even had a wildlife ecology professor that assigned us a birding project, and I was out in sketchy parts of New Haven at, 6 a.m. before dawn attempting to identify birds. So
right.
He did his best.
Not easy.
No,
not easy
not
to do
easy.
Visually.
Or by sound.
By sound, tough to do. That's why I guess we leave it to the experts like Janice Garner, who will hopefully join us in a few minutes while we're trying to get her on the phone. In the meantime, we did have a news item we did want to cover, kind of a year in review thing.
That's right.
The
Some
top.
Kind of highlights.
Yeah, what were
not
the,
just the big ones, but the positive things.
What were the big stories? So while we're waiting for Janice to get on the phone, let's start. What did you come up with?
All right. So a lot of different organizations came out with, the top 10 highlights from the year. And in kind of looking through all of these, I picked bits and pieces that we had covered and that are kind of important to us. So the first one on the top of the list is the U.S.-China Climate Accord. And there's been some skepticism as to how valuable this really is.
Right.
But there's a lot of thought that in the long term, it'll prove to be hugely important.
Big step.
Big step, right? And then the European Union also pledged to reduce emissions by 40% by 2030, with a 27% increase in renewables. There's, all kinds of things happening on that front. So
okay.
that's a big one.
In the greenhouse gas category.
Right.
Some
that climate change
forward.
Action.
Okay.
Number two, President Obama created the world's largest marine protected area.
Where's that?
That's a big one. He expanded the Pacific Remote Islands National Marine Monument from 87,000 square miles to, 490,000 square miles. So
wow.
It's huge. It doubles the global amount of protected oceans and will also help with, some fish populations and things along those lines.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Well, that's right.
Well done. We need that.
We do.
Before Congress, puts an amendment in the XL pipeline bill to rescind.
Yes.
That.
Yeah.
We'll see that.
They're going to lay the XL pipeline on the bottom of the Pacific Ocean.
Yes, we'll see that starting tomorrow when that bill gets written up, then gets through committee. But let's
That's
all right,
right.
So we'll get returned to your top 10 lists.
Top 13, technically.
13, of course, top 10 plus 3. But let's turn our attention back to the Christmas bird count. This is something sponsored by Audubon Society every year. It's been, I believe, it's. Over 100 years they've been doing this, and joining us on the phone to talk about the Christmas bird count that was held here in Park City is Janice Garner. She's a wildlife biologist and consultant with Ecology and the Environment down in Salt Lake City. Janice, thanks for joining Nell and me on This Green Earth this morning.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, well let's start with the basics. The Christmas bird count here in Park City, when was that?
Is that the Park City Christmas bird count was back on December 14th, before the holiday, and this was our fourth Christmas bird count in Park City. And as you said, you were correct. The Christmas bird count nationally has been going on for actually 115 years. The first one started in the year 1900.
Wow. Okay. And this is the fourth one here in Park City.
Correct.
Where was it held? Where did you go?
So it was held, basically, the way that the Christmas bird count works is that there are, they call these count circles, and there are these circles that are 15 miles in diameter. And in Utah, we have about, I think, 24 Christmas bird counts. So we have about 24 of these, so to speak, circles. And folks get together, and they sort of divide and conquer these circles and count as many birds as they can.
So which... group are you with? Are you associated with Audubon, an Audubon chapter itself? Is there a local group?
Yeah, so there is a number of local birding groups that sort of sponsor or participate in these. And just in general, you know, anyone from the public can always participate in a Christmas bird count. Great, so like Audubon participates in these, as well as a group called Utah Birders, and they started the Park City Christmas bird count 4 years ago, mostly because, believe it or not, Park City and Summit County is sort of an underreported birding area. There's not a lot of folks reporting their bird sightings in the Park City area, so really? They were interested in sort of bumping up those numbers and seeing what birds are up there.
So what is the motivation for the Christmas bird count? You know, obviously a lot of data is collected, but give us the bigger picture on why Audubon focuses on this.
Yeah, so actually back in the year 1900, the Christmas bird count really started. So traditionally, apparently, on Christmas Day, folks used to grab their guns, I guess with their families, and they'd have a competition about how many birds and also, mammals that they could shoot on Christmas Day.
What a way to start the new year.
What a way to start the
Christmas feast.
Holiday. And, yeah. And I presume would eat that.
Right.
And then, around that time is when people really started becoming concerned with bird populations. So a man named Frank Chapman decided that instead of shooting animals, that they would start recording the birds they saw. And then that is how it first started. And I think there's about 30 participants that year back in 1900. And this gentleman was also the founder, essentially, of Audubon. It was called Bird Lore, and now it's turned into National Audubon Society. So folks have been doing these counts all over the country, like I said, for 115 years. And Audubon is able to track different trends with all this, what we call citizen science data. It's pretty impressive.
So recording these birds, does that have to be done visually or can it be done by sound?
It can be done both ways.
Okay.
And any good birder definitely uses bird sounds to help identify birds, especially when they're singing in the springtime and there's lots of vegetation out. You don't always get great looks at birds, so knowing their calls is very important. Of course, for the Christmas bird count, a lot of birds are pretty quiet this time. They're not breeding, so usually we're seeing a lot of birds that we count.
I'm sorry if you answered this already, but why Christmas time? Why not another time? Or are bird counts held other times of the year?
You know, there are different bird counts held other times of the year, but this is just sort of a traditional, like I said, it started from sort of these hunting things and back in the early Persian. But it's just sort of become a tradition to census birds this time of year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a good activity. You know, people have free time, and it's really become a tradition for a lot of people to participate in the Christmas bird count.
So tell us some of the, you know, I guess, uses that this data is put to. Where does it go once it's been collected and compiled by Audubon?
So Audubon came out with a study a number of years ago, and they looked at 40 years of data from the Christmas bird count. And obviously, you know, you can imagine that all sorts of statistical analyses goes into this, because every year there's different folks counting. So, for example, in 2011, the first year of the Park City bird count, there was 14 people, and this past year we had 20 people in the count. So we saw a lot more birds this year. The weather was a little bit different. It was warmer, so we had more open water. You know, all the lakes and ponds weren't frozen, so we saw a lot more ducks this year. Mm-hmm. So they're able to kind of smooth out some of that stuff and come up with trends. Unfortunately, that study that Audubon compiled had a lot of pretty depressing news.
Oh.
And as I'm sure we can imagine, most bird species and populations are in decline.
Right. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Janice Garner. She's a wildlife biologist with the environmental consulting firm of Ecology and Environment down in Salt Lake City. And we're talking about the Park City's Christmas bird count that was held here back on December 14th. So, okay, so what did you see?
So we saw a lot of great winter birds. As you can imagine, a lot of our birds leave for warmer climates in the winter, but what's kind of neat about Utah is that we actually have a lot of birds that breed up in the Arctic and the tundra eras, and we only see them in the wintertime.
Hmm.
So some neat birds that we were able to see were like the American tree sparrow, which is only a winter resident in Utah. And that, I believe it was the first time that we saw American tree sparrows in Park City at this Christmas bird count. So that was a good bird. We also see a lot of waterfowl, and of course, we're always happy to see some raptors like bald eagle, golden eagle, and this year we even saw a prairie falcon.
Oh, okay.
So, bird Summit County.
So a couple of unusual sightings.
Yeah. And we also rely a lot, we spend a lot of time driving around Summit County and visiting all of the folks' bird feeders that they have up. And at bird feeders, we get the Clark's Nutcracker, dark-eyed juncos, downy woodpeckers, let's see, what else? Black-capped chickadees, mountain chickadees. Those are some other common birds that we see over in the Park City Christmas bird count.
So how many birds total were recorded this year?
How many birds total? Well, this year, the Park City Christmas bird count, we recorded 65 species. And I think altogether, it was probably close to 1,000 individual birds were counted. And we had, like I said, about 20 people making those counts.
Wow.
And so you record individual birds in addition to the species?
We do, yeah. So if we stop at a bird feeder, we'll count up, you know, all the black-capped chickadees that we see, all the Caston's finches we see, and mark that down. And at the end of the day, we tally all the numbers, and then we submit that to National Audubon.
Did you count how many house cats you see hanging around at the bird feeders?
Luckily, we didn't see any house cats on the Christmas bird count. But, yeah, I think what you're alluding to is that, yeah, house cats can have pretty detrimental impacts on our bird population.
Detrimental? You're being kind, Janice.
Yeah.
And the research I've read, it's millions of birds, mostly small upland species like that, the chickadees and the juncos and the finches, are killed tens of millions every year by house cats. The numbers are astounding.
So. It's actually more than 1 billion.
Oh, okay.
You're underestimating.
I'm not even close at 10 million. It's 1 billion. I think it's like it has to be 10 million a week.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate. And I'm sure most cat owners that let their cats roam outside, they've had their cat come home with a songbird before.
Yeah.
And then you multiply that with all the stray and feral cats out there, and it has pretty significant impacts on birds. And as cat lovers and bird lovers, it's one of the easiest things we can do is keep our cats indoors.
Well put. Easier said than done, but well put.
Right.
Given if we talk more about this, that it's hundreds and hundreds of millions of birds killed by cats every day. This is what I kind of pull out whenever anybody says, oh, wind farms are going to kill a lot of birds and they're detrimental and they're going to ruin species. I know we're talking about different species, raptors and soars,
sure,
wind farms versus small upland species, but believe me, house cats do far more damage to our bird populations and are probably playing a role in bird declines in this country than wind farms.
Absolutely, but I have to jump on board to add that feral cats appear to be a growing problem in the Park City area and the Standerville Basin.
Really?
So if you see cats that you think are feral, please do call animal control, or if you see them in the basin, you can even call the Swanner Nature Preserve.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, Janice, getting back to what you guys did you come across or find anything that you didn't see? I mean, you saw some unusual species, but were there species that you expected to see and didn't see? Are there changes afoot there?
Well, like I said, the Park City Christmas bird count has only been going on for 4 years, so trends are a little bit difficult at this time. Mm. But as you guys know, we had a really warm fall, and so when we did the Christmas bird count this December, we had a lot of open water, whereas in previous years, all the ponds and lakes were frozen. So we saw some new waterfowl, and we actually saw two species of gulls, and we had never seen gulls in Park City during the bird counts in previous years. So not everyone loves gulls, but some birders are crazy for them. So that was an exciting find for a few folks.
Do you guys get competitive out there? Who sees the most unusual species?
Absolutely. There's a lot of birders that are quite competitive. So one thing that is nice is we have, you know, almost an entire year before the next Christmas bird count. But anyone can participate in sort of citizen science anytime with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. They have this website called eBird, and it is completely free, and you can put in the birds that you've seen, whether they're in your backyard feeder or if you've actually gone out on a nice hike and tallied all the birds you've seen. So you can participate in bird censusing any time of the year. And not only can you submit your data, but you can see what other people are seeing, and it keeps track of what you and other folks in the community are seeing. So it's kind of a fun thing. It can get a little bit competitive because you can see who's been tracking more birds or, you know, going on the more birdie outings. But it's great because the University of Cornell is able to use that data, much like the Christmas bird count, and do some pretty neat things, tracking bird trends and populations.
Does the sighting need to be confirmed? So I'm just not out there by myself, and I come back to the group and say, oh, I saw three Asian strays, and I think an ivory-billed woodpecker.
Well, they do have moderators, They do have moderators that go through, and, you know, if they see anything funny, they'll sort of flag it, and it won't be used. They kind of doubt those funny observations.
So good science is used.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Let's talk about the last few minutes. The decline, the general declines that Audubon is reporting across the country. What are some of those species?
So it was a couple of years ago. National Audubon looked at a lot of their data from the Christmas bird count, and there was 10 species that really stood out as being in severe decline. And in the past 40 years, they had 80% declines in their population. Hmm. Two of those species are still somewhat common in Utah, and they are the evening grosbeak, which some folks in Park City may see those at their bird feeder. That's a really pretty yellow and black bird, kind of robin size.
Right.
Another one is a northern pintail, which is a very gorgeous duck, popular among hunters, and it's a great bird. These two species had pretty significant declines in their populations. And really, most of that is just really attributed to habitat loss. That's the number one reason that birds are in decline, is it's all about habitat loss. For the evening grosbeak, it's a mountain bird. So they think that some issues with bark beetles and logging. And for northern pintail, they rely heavily on wetlands, especially in the prairie region. And a lot of those wetlands have been converted to agriculture and development. So those are the two biggies for why birds are in decline.
Yeah, I mean, the evening grosbeak is what got me as a little kid starting in birding because we had backyard feeder. And those things are beautiful birds. Like you say, they're striking yellow and black and white. And they're very regal looking. You know, they're just like a cardinal type of beak. And they're just very regal looking. And, of course, the sunflowers. Sunflower seeds only, please. That's it. Nothing else but sunflower seeds if you want to draw them to your feeder. But they declined dramatically from my backyard birding experiences in New Jersey. Like from 1 year to the next, they went from flocks of them to nothing around the early 80s. And they never came back. At least that was in. And so it's nice to know that maybe they're around here. You can spot them around here.
Yeah.
So,
but okay, before we wrap up, yeah, I just want to ask, how can people get involved with you and your group if they want to join in on the Christmas bird count or take part in birding outings or things along those lines?
Yeah, so there's a number of ways to get involved in the birding community. There is a number of Audubon chapters in Utah. The closest one, there's Bridgerland Audubon, Wasatch Audubon, and there is the Great Salt Lake Audubon. There's also a group called the Utah Birders. There's also birding clubs, if you will, or organizations in Utah County. So there's a number of different ways. So if you just kind of go on Google and seek out some of those. And like I mentioned, there's always eBird, and that's a really great way for folks to get involved mm-hmm. in birding and citizen science. And it's really fun, too.
Yeah, it is. What's your favorite bird?
Oh, my gosh, I have too many. I always love an American kestrel, and the black-necked stilt is one of my favorites as well, which is a water bird that's pretty common on the Great Salt Lake.
On the Great Salt Lake, yeah. Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Janice Gardner. She's a wildlife biologist and with the consulting firm down Salt Lake City of Ecology and the Environment, and she was involved in this year's Christmas bird count up here in Park City. And thanks again for taking the time, Janice.
Thanks so much, and happy birding in 2015, everyone.
You bet.
Thank
All
you.
Right. Okay, bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye. Thanks. And let's take a break for some underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, we've got a few more minutes to talk about some of the rest of that top 10 list.
That's right.
Environmental stories for 2014. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney.
Join us for The Mountain Life Wednesday at 9 a.m. From narcissism to the social instinct of trust.
From training like an Olympian to rowing across oceans.
From racing the Tour of Utah to cruising the Round Valley Trails. It's all on The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. Wednesday at 9 a.m. Brought to you by
Park City Bonanza Instacare, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design,
Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that is Christopher Cherniak across the board. And we wanted to bring you some of the biggest environmental successes, the good news from 2014, mm-hmm. Now that we've wrapped up that year.
Yeah, and we had three already.
That's right. We talked about the U.S.-China Climate Accord,
right.
The world's largest protected marine area.
And where was that again?
In the Pacific Islands.
Pacific Islands.
Yep.
Okay.
And
what's next?
Next, the U.S. Congress protected new national parks and wilderness areas.
What?
Which came as...
They did that?
I talked about that, Chris. Come on. Which came as a little bit of a surprise because
you include in the same sentence, U.S. Congress,
right.
You know, did something.
Did anything.
Yes.
So definitely the biggest land conservation bill since 2009 set aside nearly 250,000 acres of wilderness in the American West, created and expanded more than a dozen national parks, and added more than 100 miles of rivers to the national wild and scenic river systems. So that was super exciting.
Yeah, good for them.
And there's not much in Utah, but there are things in other neighboring states. So
yeah
you can go visit
bit
those.
Every helps. Okay.
That's right. Next up is the Wilderness Act turned 50 years old. And that's more of like a milestone. But it's something that we celebrated this year. It's 50th anniversary. It provides the Wilderness Act provides the highest levels of protection for open space and conserved land. So
basically it's land designated to be off limits to any
motorized vehicle,
or you can go in,
no mountain bikes,
but you got to come out.
Right.
No development, no management.
No management.
Well, okay. Effectively, little to no management of even of vegetation or wildlife, et cetera.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And this one, the next one I've got on the list, is probably my favorite. The Colorado River reached its delta for the first time in over 50 years.
Explain, what does that mean?
So the Colorado River had been sucked dry from, you know, all of the various uses that we humans need to use it for.
Sure.
But there was this huge collaborative agreement between the U.S. government and Mexico and states and agencies and nonprofits. And they provided a pulse flow where they provided a really high flow of water until the river reached the sea, which it hadn't done in decades and decades. So those downstream environments and even the groundwater received really some benefits from that. So obviously it's not the same as having a consistently flowing river, but it does do, definitely does do a lot of good.
Yeah. It's a start, and maybe this program will continue such that the Colorado River actually goes to its terminus in the Gulf of California.
Right.
Right.
And that's also kind of like an equity issue and an ethics issue amongst people, right? Because when you take all the water, you know, the majority of it in the U.S., then the people that are living downstream are not getting the benefit of that water.
Well, because we have lots of golf courses to water.
Las Vegas. You got to keep that.
We have all those water features
Kentucky
there.
Bluegrass, green.
Kentucky bluegrass in St. George and Arizona. That's why the river shouldn't end in the Gulf of California. It should stay in this country. And that's what
let's not let it cross the border.
No. No, it's a border program. Okay, we got
to... That's right. We're going to have to fly. Okay, the U.S. EPA proposed limits, the first ever national limits on CO2 from power plants. And they also strengthened tailpipe emissions rules in a big way. The New York State banned fracking. That was that's another favorite one of mine. Wolves were, proclaimed endangered, so they're protected at least, you know, for another little while. Alaska's Bristol Bay mine was stopped.
Right.
So that was huge. Yeah.
Okay.
So those are some of the big highlights.
Lots of good news per se with respect to environmental issues. We'll see how things unfold this coming year, now that we have a new Congress and a new Republican-controlled Congress. And like we said, the XL pipeline bill will be on the president's desk sometime around Thursday at 5.
I think you were going to start a countdown on that, huh? Is that hour by hour?
A countdown. There's actually talk of attaching amendments to it that can kind of sweeten the pot because they need some Democratic votes to override a veto. So they may sweeten the pot with some energy efficiency amendments or some other infrastructure amendments. We'll see how that unfolds, but it's going to happen, and it's going to happen quickly. And then the president's going to have to decide whether to veto or not, and then the Congress has to figure out if they have enough votes to override his veto. We'll talk more about that next year.
Next week.
I'm sorry.
We'll give you the update.
Yeah. Well, we gotta hustle out of here. Thanks again for joining us this week. Let's thank our underwriters for whom this show is made possible. They include
Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
and Vail Resorts.
You can always join us on Facebook and like us there at KPCW, This Green Earth.
Or email us your thoughts or ideas at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.